Hey, folks, welcome to Music in Time on WGXC. I'm your host, Evan McCormick. By day, a historian at Columbia University, but by night, I'm a music lover. And this show is my attempt to bring those two worlds together, seeing how music can help us understand the past and how the past can help us think differently about music. Now, before we get started today, I want to make a special plea. We are currently in the midst of a pledge drive here at WGXC. This show and others like it on WGXC are supported by listeners like you. So I want to ask, would you consider making a donation to the station that hosts Music in Time and other shows like it, WGXC? Notwithstanding its very lean operating budget, WGXC is a wellspring of sonic creativity and community here in the Hudson River Valley, and of course, always available for you to stream from afar as well. So would you consider becoming a sustaining supporter by pledging, say, $10 a month? We're currently looking to secure additional sustaining supporters towards the ultimate goal of $5,000 in monthly contributions. That amount would allow us to get out of the business of traditional pledge drives altogether. So to get there, all we need to do is add a minimum of $1,250 in monthly donations during this drive, which runs until the 28th, and you could help. Any amount that you can give will help us towards our goal. Sustaining support is charged monthly to your credit card or PayPal account at any level you choose. It's tax deductible, a charitable contribution, and easy to cancel at any time. So to make a recurring donation or to make a one-time gift, please visit wgxc.org/donate or call 518-697-7400. And if you mention me on social media after making a donation, I will give you a shout out on our next show, or better yet, have an idea for a show, let me know that too. Now, on to Music in Time. Welcome back to Music in Time on WGXC. I'm your host, Evan McCormick. The idea behind this show is that we use music as a lens to explore the past. We take a new album each episode, and we look at its historical context, what was going on around it, to understand what listeners might have been thinking about as they connected with music in its own time. And today we're going to be focusing on the Beatles' final album, Abbey Road, which came out in September 1969. And I want to use Abbey Road specifically to talk about Paul McCartney. Born in 1942 in Liverpool, Paul McCartney went on to form one of the all-time great songwriting partnerships with John Lennon. He rose to international fame with the Beatles and had a long and storied career with Wings and as a solo artist. He's one of our living musical legends, still making music and performing today. Or is he? That's right, listeners. What I actually want to talk to you about today is the long-running conspiracy, or hoax, depending on how you see it, that Paul McCartney, Sir Paul McCartney, is in fact long deceased. This was a conspiracy that blew up in late 1969, right after the release of the album Abbey Road. I'm guessing if you're listening to WGXC, this might not be the first time you've heard a reference to Paul is dead. But whether you're familiar with the theory or this is your introduction to it, I hope you'll find something interesting in today's show. And I want to be very clear at the outset. I don't believe this conspiracy theory, and I'm not here to propagate it. Paul McCartney is very much alive, thankfully. But as a historian, I do want to try and explain this conspiracy theory, from its origins to understanding why it caught on like wildfire at the moment that it did, to why it lived on for so long, what it means today, whether there might be other moments that help us make sense of such a bizarre musical myth. But we're going to start today right where the rumor started, which was the fall of 1969, specifically September 26th of that year when Abbey Road hit record store shelves, with a cover that would turn out to be memorable for some unintended reasons. The Beatles passing through a crosswalk just outside Abbey Road Studios, looking conspicuously like characters you might find at a funeral. And third in line, just in front of George Harrison, looking a bit like a gravedigger, was Paul McCartney in Bare Feet. Here's the first track off that record, Come Together. On October 12, 1969, a listener phoned in to Detroit's WKNR radio station and told DJ Uncle Russ Gibb that he was compiling evidence from Beatles records that Paul McCartney, the cute Beatle, was dead. Now, we'll come to that evidence in a second, but first I want to tell you the story of how this call ballooned into something more. Uncle Russ Gibb spent the better part of his show exploring the evidence with the listener, and it became a running attraction on WKNR's radio station over the ensuing weeks to debate the idea that Paul McCartney was in fact dead. It's worth perhaps noting that WKNR was in a ratings battle, and this certainly helped. WKNR even produced an audio documentary that fall called The Beatle Plot. The conspiracy got a boost from a source that may seem unlikely now, from college newspapers, especially in the American Midwest, which I find interesting. First, it was the Michigan Daily at the University of Michigan, where a student named Fred Labor wrote a review of Abbey Road, which was meant to be satire, that presented the clues on the album that McCartney was no longer with us. I've already mentioned McCartney and his bare feet on the album cover, how people are buried, the myth alleged. And then there was a license plate in the background of the album cover, which read 28 if, or as the theorists had it, 28 years old that Paul McCartney would be if he had not died in 1966. And with the story in print, it took off. Like, really took off. I'm telling you, if you take a look at the newspaper archives from fall 1969, there were hundreds of columns that ran about the theory of Paul being dead. And more importantly, people, well, some people, apparently believed it. Julie Morris, a writer for the Detroit Free Press, filed a story in mid-October that reported, quote, "Beatlemaniacs from a hysterical Southfield high school girl to Eastern Michigan University fraternity brothers have gone scurrying to their record collections to ferret out clues that hint McCartney died in 1966, end quote. Even Life magazine was reporting on the story. In a feature published in early November titled The Magical McCartney Mystery, something we'll come back to in a second, Life reported that, quote, thousands and thousands of distraught Beatles fans were anxiously weighing the, quote, evidence and concluding that some mishap had befallen Paul McCartney. He had died, or something, they figured. That's the Life story. But by this time, the news was already spreading like wildfire. There were Paul is Dead societies cropping up at universities. A DJ at a Miami radio station even got fired for discussing the theory on air and going a bit too deep. Meanwhile, like any good myth, it had other origin stories. A sophomore at Drake University in Iowa, who was sports editor at the school paper, he had begun compiling clues and published them in a story in September, even before the Detroit radio show, and claimed credit for the theory. That fall, the Paul is Dead myth took on a life of its own. And during this pandemonium, well, Abbey Road sold 2 million copies in 2 weeks. I guess you could say that the rumor mill was good for sales. All this despite claims from none other than Paul McCartney that he was very much alive. One newspaper columnist in Redwood, California, seemed to sum up the confusion when he described trying to reassure his distraught teenage daughter that Paul himself had come forward to say he was okay. The daughter's reply? Well, what does he know? I like to think of this song as Paul's answer to the disbelief. Oh, darling, please believe me. I'll never do you no harm. Believe me when I tell you, I'll never do you no harm. Welcome back to Music in Time on WGXC. I'm your host, Evan McCormick, and today we're listening to Abbey Road, because it was after that album's release in the fall of 1969 that the theory that Beatle Paul McCartney was dead started to emerge. But notably, the myth itself stretched back in time, through earlier Beatles releases dating back to 1966. In 1969, hunting clues laid by the Beatles over previous albums became something of a sport. So what were these clues? Well, I'll tell you, but let me remind you first, I'm not a party to this conspiracy theory. I just think these are the clues that bear the most scrutiny. Think of them as historical evidence. Many of them were images. On the cover of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band from 1967, Paul McCartney, on the album cover, has a hand quite obviously raised above his head, something that the theorists claimed was an Eastern symbol of death. In the liner notes for that album, also quite obviously, Paul McCartney appears backwards while all of the other Beatles face the camera. And a patch on his sleeve inside the liner notes, well, that reads OPD, which believers claimed were initials that stood for officially pronounced dead. On the album Magical Mystery Tour, Paul had appeared, fans believed, as the Black Walrus, something that they claimed was a folk symbol of death. And in the liner notes, he had worn a black carnation, while the other Beatles were wearing red flowers. Perhaps most dramatically, the cover of the 1966 album Yesterday and Today features the band in white butcher coats holding pieces of raw meat and disassembled baby dolls. Yeah, it's something. Anyways, on Paul McCartney's lap sits a decapitated head. The outline of the theory started to take shape, that Paul McCartney had died some years before 1969 in a car crash. At that time, he had been replaced in the Beatles by a fill-in who was named William Campbell, or Billy Shears for short, the singer referenced in the opening track of Sgt. Pepper, if you caught that. Armed with that information, the clues started to appear everywhere for the Paul is Dead theorists, especially in the Beatles' own lyrics. Viewed through that lens, the lyrics did seem to be obsessed with death and accidents. Think about this line from A Day in the Life from Sgt. Pepper.
He blew his mind out in a car. He didn't notice that the lights had changed. A crowd of stood and stared. They'd seen his face before. Nobody was really sure he was on the house of
law. On 1968's The White Album, the group seemed to be getting even more meta. There were clues littered throughout the album, like this on Don't Pass Me By.
I'm sorry that I doubted you. I was so unfair. You were in a car crash, and you lost your hair.
And in the song Glass Onion from the White Album, John Lennon even seemed to reference the fact that people would be hunting for clues.
I told you about the walrus and me, man. You know that we're as close as can be, man. Well, here's another clue for you all. The walrus was Paul.
Theorists also began to scour Beatles albums for audio clues. What do I mean by that? Well, the idea was that the Beatles were actually hiding references to Paul's death in the music itself. On Strawberry Fields Forever, one of Beatles' most famous songs, at the very end, after the music fades out, if you listen very closely, you can hear John Lennon mutter something that sounds like, well, I'll let you tell me what you think. So was it cranberry sauce, as John Lennon would later claim, or was it I buried Paul, as the theorists would claim? And then there was the backmasking. What's backmasking, you ask? Well, that's a technique where an artist or producer records audio in reverse and then dubs it into a track. effectively hiding it for listeners to unlock by playing the record backwards, unveiling a secret message, or so theorists believe. And it was in Revolution No. 9 on the White Album, a cacophonous track on the second record, which seemed to hold the most clues. When played backwards, the song contained some conspicuous sound effects, that of a car crashing, of people wailing in pain, sirens. And then there was the song's refrain. You know it well.
Number 9, number 9.
Now flip that around and you hear something a little bit different and a little bit creepier. John's voice saying something that sounded to the Paul is Dead believers like, "Turn me on, dead man.
Turn me on, dead man. Turn me on, dead man. Turn me on, dead man. Turn me on, dead man. Turn me on, dead man. Turn me on, dead man. Turn me on, dead man."
Backmasking has been the source of so much controversy and conspiracy in music history, and much of it is frankly ridiculous. Artists have had fun with this trick, but usually what it is that listeners are hearing what they want to hear. To show you what I mean, I'm going to play another song that was the subject of some backmasking controversies in the 1970s. Queen's famous Another One Bites the Dust. During the iconic chorus, listeners thought they heard something a little bit more subversive. Quote, "It's fun to smoke marijuana." Now count me among the disbelievers. I bet if I hadn't prefaced that clip, you never would have known what you were listening to. It only makes me want to hear the song the way it's meant to be played. Here's Another One Bites the Dust by Queen.
Let's go! He walks barely down the street with the brim pool way down low. Ain't no sound but the sound of his feet. Machine guns ready to go. Are you ready? Hey, are you ready for this? Are you hanging on the edge of your seat? Out of the doorway, the bullets rip. To the sound of the beat, yeah. Another one bites the dust. Another one bites the dust. And another one gone, and another one gone. Another one bites the dust, hey. Hey, I'm gonna get you too. Another one bites the dust.
Welcome back to Music in Time on WGXC. I'm your host, Evan McCormick, and today we're discussing the Paul is Dead conspiracy, or hoax, depending on how you look at it, that took off in 1969, right after the release of Abbey Road. Before that song by Queen, you heard some of the evidence, and I want to start to explain the why. Why did this theory take root? And I mean, why did it take root in 1969? Why not in 1968, after the White Album itself came out, or Sgt. Pepper the year before, with some of the clues that I mentioned? And to explain that, I'm going to take you to an unexpected time and place. It's 1994 in South Florida, when I, your host, was just a teenager, rollerblading around my suburban neighborhood, listening to music on my cassette tape Walkman. Well, one fateful day, I dropped that Walkman, and a funny thing happened. The button that was supposed to flip the cassette tape over automatically, well, it started doing something else. It started playing my cassette tapes in reverse. So I did what any music-obsessed teenager would have done. I immediately grabbed a cassette of the Beatles' White Album, and I listened to Revolution Number 9 in reverse. But I also caught another famous moment of backmasking. Right after the song I'm So Tired on the first record of the White Album, you hear John Lennon mumble something quietly. This is what it sounds like when you're playing it forward. But with my newly unlocked backmask-revealing Walkman powers, I flipped the tape and in reverse heard this. Did you catch it? Paul is a dead man. Miss him, miss him. Well, at least that's what so many theorists in 1969 thought they heard. But in 1994, I thought I heard it too. Take a listen again. It was as if I had unlocked the Beatles' codex. I immediately went online. It was Prodigy and AOL bulletin boards back then, and I devoured all I could find about the Paul is Dead lore. I felt like I had gained access to some closely kept secret. This had to mean something. It had to be intentional, right? But anyways, what does my experience in 1994 have to do with the story of the Paul is Dead conspiracy theory in 1969? But first, I'd like to make a plea. Are you enjoying my show? If so, would you consider becoming a sustaining supporter of WGXC? During this pledge drive, we're looking for sustaining supporters to help the station reach its goal of $5,000 in monthly contributions. You can help us make pledge drives a thing of the past by becoming a sustaining supporter of WGXC. Would you consider $10 a month? It would go a long way to supporting shows like Music in Time and many others that make WGXC a powerhouse and independent, listener-supported local radio. Sustaining support is easy to set up. It's a tax-deductible charitable contribution and easy to cancel at any time. To make a recurring donation or to make a one-time gift, visit wgxc.org/donate or call 518-697-7400. And now back to the Beatles. So why did I tell you that story about me in 1994, listening to the Beatles backwards, scouring the early internet for clues about Paul is Dead? I was impressionable. I was undiscerning, but I also had a wealth of information at my fingertips. All of those ingredients made me think that I was discovering something, a secret knowledge for the first time. So maybe there's a clue to understanding 1969 in my experience in the 1990s. It's worth spending a few minutes here just to point out that disproving the theory that Paul was dead was almost as much of a cottage industry as propagating the theory itself. First, it was Apple Records, the Beatles themselves, and of course Paul McCartney, who went to great lengths to disprove the myth that Paul was dead. Earlier, I mentioned that Life magazine feature from November. Well, in addition to covering the conspiracy, the feature was designed to show readers proof of life for Paul, who, by the way, revealed in the article that he was enjoying his life out of the limelight after Linda gave birth to their daughter a few months before. There were other efforts as well, though. Here's one of my favorites. On November 30th, New York station WOR aired a television special titled Paul McCartney, The Complete Story Told for the First and Last Time, in which a lawyer cross-examined Fred Labor, the University of Michigan student I mentioned who wrote the piece in the student newspaper about Paul is dead. Now, the story goes that Labor told the lawyer right before going on air that the whole thing was a joke anyway, but with an hour of TV to fill, they went through with the bit. Oh, that lawyer, by the way, was F. Lee Bailey. Yeah. In the short term, some of these efforts seem to cool the flames of the conspiracy theory. And yet, as I've already alluded to, the urban legend lived on. In fact, even as it was being proven to be bunk in 1969, it was congealing into something that would stand the test of time, an increasingly sprawling web of clues. I mean, by the time that I found it in the 1990s, the Paul is Dead theory incorporated dozens and dozens and dozens of pieces of evidence. Really ridiculous ones: that lovely Rita Metermaid had been present for Paul's death, that the song Blue Jay Way is actually George Harrison's funeral oration for Paul. What had started as an appeal to curiosity, certain things in the Beatles' music that needed some explanation, it had developed into its own kind of truth system in which almost everything could be interpreted as in some way pointing back to Paul being dead. So perhaps the question isn't, why did people believe it? But the question is, why was the urge to believe it something that outweighed a much more boring truth? That Paul was alive and that the Beatles were having a little fun with their fans. I think to answer that question, you need to understand the context. What was happening around the album's release that colored the way people heard that album, heard those clues? 1969 was a period of tremendous cynicism and lack of trust in the United States. And it was in the United States where this myth drew most of its energy. This was also a dark period. Americans had seen the deaths of several prominent political leaders, Martin Luther King Jr., Robert Kennedy the year before. It was less than a decade removed from the killing of John F. Kennedy, which had given birth to one of America's longest-running conspiracies. Of course, we're still a few years away from Watergate, but in the mid-1960s, with the Vietnam War, the rise of the counterculture, belief in institutions was being replaced with skepticism, especially among young people. Most of the people taking up the Paul is Dead theory, debating it, discussing it, they were young, and they were accessing information in new ways on college radio stations, student newspapers, through listening clubs. These could all give them the impression that they were accessing prized information that other people weren't privy to. It was a glimpse behind the curtain. I've got more to say, but here are my three favorite tracks off Abbey Road, the trifecta of Mean Mr. Mustard, Polythene Pam, and She Came In Through the Bathroom Window.
Mean Mr. Mustard sleeps in the park, shaves in the dark, trying to save paper. Sleeps in a hole in the road, saving up to buy some clothes. Keeps a 10-bob note up his nose. Such a mean old. Stop. She's a go-getter. Takes him out to look at the queen. Only place that he's ever been. Always shouts out something obscene. Such a dirty old man. Dirty old man.
Welcome back to Music in Time on WGXC. I'm your host, Evan McCormick. We're listening to Abbey Road and talking about the Paul is Dead conspiracy theory that took off after the album's release in the fall of 1969. And there are two things I want to say as we enter the home stretch of the show here. The first is just to reiterate, this conspiracy theory is bunk. Do not believe it. Paul is alive and well to this day. That the second thing I wanted to say is that conspiracy theories are nothing new or unique to this period. They're always present. No matter how outlandish, how much evidence to the contrary, they're always appealing and always hard to snuff out. They take on a life of their own. Academic research has shown that this is true, that conspiracy theories have this power because they're universally appealing, regardless of sex, political affiliation, age, income. Everyone you know is likely to believe a conspiracy theory. And researchers believe that there are psychological explanations for this, for how people become attached to these ideas, a mix of confirmation bias, what's called proportionality bias, believing that big events must have big causes, and illusory pattern perception, a phenomenon which is seeing causal relationships in things that are actually unconnected. But I would urge you to think here that there are moments when a constellation of social factors increases the currency that conspiracy theories hold. Factors like declining trust in institutions, especially conflicts over media institutions, status anxiety. These are things that can drive people to value outlandish explanations over commonly held wisdom. And we know this because we're living through such a moment right now. For decades, historians and political commentators have spoken about a conspiratorial style in American politics. In recent years, ideas like QAnon, birther conspiracies, vaccine conspiracies, they become more like ideologies to a small but alarming percentage of the population, often fueled by communities that abandon mainstream media in favor of closed groups that trade in their ability to decipher clues. And I think 1969 was a mirror of a moment like this one. Maybe so was the early 90s when I came to the Paul is Dead myth. But let's be clear, there's nothing so dangerous as this in the myth that Paul is dead, at least if you're not Paul McCartney, because while I would argue that all of these things that researchers say about conspiracy thinking are true in the case of Paul is Dead, because it's pop culture, there's a knowing relationship between the listener and the artist that lets you know all of the mystery is in good fun. It's in the name of creativity. And that's what the Beatles were all about, after all. They weren't just creating music. They were creating an entire world in which their listeners could live. Wanted to live, something like an alternate reality, one which involved knowing and loving the members, but also a sense that you knew them, also creating a sense of exclusivity with them through things like fan clubs, special releases, the care that they put into each of their albums. Now, I'm not saying that the Beatles propagated the Paul is Dead myth. It's plain that by the end of the 1960s, Paul was pretty perturbed by the whole thing. But there are enough winks, enough nods, to suggest that the band was okay inviting their fans to go as deep into their world of imagery, imagination, as they wanted to go, and to connect with other people while doing it. In politics, that might be a scary thought, but in music, well, that's what helped make the Beatles the Beatles. And let's not forget one other really important factor here. In the fall of 1969, the Beatles were breaking up. And I can't tell you exactly how that factors in, but it seems really notable to me that the Paul is Dead conspiracy caught on with fans right at the moment that this beloved musical institution was about to break down. The myth that Paul McCartney was dead was not the first time that a conspiracy theory had helped to sell something, nor would it be the last. Was anybody else thinking about Tupac Shakur during this episode? The rapper was shot and killed in September of 1996, but in subsequent years, conspiracy theories abounded that Shakur was not actually dead, that he was still alive. Those conspiracy theories were compounded by several posthumous releases by the rapper, including 2002's Better Days. In something like a reversal of the Paul is Dead myth, adherence to the Tupac is Alive theory interpreted lyrics from songs like the title track to that album, Better Days, as clues that Tupac Shakur still walked the earth.
Looking for these better days. Better days. Better days, better days, better days.
our lifestyle, look how we live. Smoking you like it ain't no thing. So even kids wanna try now, then lie down and get ran through. Nobody watches them clocking the evil man do. Faced with the demons, addicted to hearing victims screaming. Guess we was evil since birth, product of curtain issues. Cause even our birthdays is cursed days. A born thug in the first place, the worst ways. I love to see the block in peace, with no more dealers and crooked cops. The only way to stop the beast, and only we can change. It's up to us to clean up the streets, it ain't the same. Too many murders, too many funerals, and too many tears. Just seen another brother buried, plus I knew him for years. Best by his family, but what could I say? Keep your head up and try to keep the faith, and pray for better days. Better day, better day. Hey, better day. Thinking about better days. Better days, better days, better days. Hey, better days. Got me thinking about better days. Thinking back as an adolescent, who would have guessed that in my future years I'd be stressing. Some say the ghetto sick and corrupt. Plus my PO won't let me hang with the brothers I grew up with. Trying to keep my head up and stay strong. All my homies slanging yeah, all day long, but they wrong. So I'm solo and so broke, saving up for some Jordans, cause they dope. I got a girl and I love her, but she broke too. And so am I can't take her to the place she wanna go to. So we argue and play fight all day and night, making passionate love to the daylight. Plus we about to get evicted, can't pay the rent. Guess it's time to see who really is your friend. Tell me you're pregnant and I'm amazed. So many blessings while we stressing, looking for them better days. Better days. Better day. Better day. Hey. Better days. Thinking about better days. Better days. Better days. Better days. Hey. Better days. Got me thinking about better days. Now me and you was real cool. Hell on them square fools. Since back in high school, we was true, me and you. Only part of them separated, we stayed faded. Affiliated with gangbangers and still made it. Up in the gym, mess with me, gotta mess with him. Still dressing like grown men when rolling. Out in the dark, smoking Newports, gaming marks. Got a place in my heart, homie, stay smart. Locked you up in the pen and gave you 3 to 10. I send you letters with naked flicks of old friends. Hoping you well, I know it's hell doing time in the cells. You need mail when you in jail. And me, I'm doing cool. I settled down, had a family, working in night school. Every once in a while, I reminisce and wonder how we ever came to this. I miss the better days. Better day, better day. Hey, thinking about better days. Better days, better days, better days. Got me thinking about better days. I send this one out to all the homeboys down in Clinton lockdown, Rikers Island, all them dudes I was locked up with. E block, F block, double H. Then I see in Rikers Island, downstate, all the peoples I met along the way. Better days is coming, homeboy. Keep your head up.
Leave me lying here, 'cause I don't wanna go. Leave me lying here.
That was Volcano Girls by Veruca Salt, which contains a sly reference to Glass Onion off the White Album and the Paul is Dead conspiracy theory, if you caught it. This is the end of this episode of Music in Time. There's so much more to say about the Paul is Dead conspiracy, but lucky for you, there's lots of great writing out there about it for you to go find. I hope this episode has made you think a little bit about what was going on in 1969, which helps explain why the conspiracy theory took off after Abbey Road in particular. I'll be back on the fourth Wednesday of next month with another episode of Music in Time. In the meantime, I'm going to leave you with some timeless Beatles wisdom from Abbey Road. In the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make.
And in the end, the love you take.